May it please the court. Your Honor, this case can be decided on three simple legal principles, upon which it becomes clear that the Buttons' claim for remainder damages cannot withstand appellate scrutiny. First, it is undisputable that not every injury to remainder of property caused by a condemnation proceeding is compensable as a matter of Texas law. Second, one of the categories of clearly non-compensable injuries to remainders of property is precisely what the Buttons claim in this case: damages based on projected costs of modifying hypothetical development plans on the property. And third, even if those costs were compensable under Texas law, and they are not, the Buttons experts offered no evidence to support any remainder damages award in this case because their testimony is speculative, conclusory, and analytically flawed. The Buttons offered two expert witnesses for proof of their remainder damages in this case, and those were Mr. Cross and Ms. Wickliffe. Mr. Cross went first, and his testimony went to the theory of why the remainder property was injured in this case. And Mr. Cross, I'm not sure if the court has the briefs in the case before us, but if you do have appellant's brief at page 18, you can go very specifically to what Mr. Cross testified to, and it's the block quote in the middle. It says, "I've done a site plan. I've hypothetically created three crossings that might be necessary. However, that's a hypothetical, and there could be any number of different combinations in the actual development. That site plan was prepared hypothetically as a possibility. There are millions of possibilities for how this site can develop." And then he went on to discuss, which are the quotations above that on the same page, all the different ways that the site could possibly develop and the possible conflicts that could theoretically occur if the site was developed in any particular theoretical manner. But under Texas law, an expert in appraisal may not testify to purely hypothetical and speculative costs.
Let me ask you this. Was the evidence that it was going to be developed in some way?
No, Your Honor, not at all. The evidence was the opposite. There were no current or pending plans. There were no current or pending contracts on the property. There was no bid made on the property to develop it. There was no contemplated plan provided. There was absolutely no evidence whatsoever of any current or pending project on the property. It's completely hypothetical.
That's exactly my question. My question was this in an area that was going to be developed? Like, were they developing around? Don't nod your head, please. Were they developing around it? Is this an area that they're going to use as a disposal site for nuclear waste, and so it will never be developed? What have we got here?
No, certainly there are surrounding near area properties that were being developed. But the question, Your Honor, is not what's happening on other properties.
That wasn't my question. My question was this in the area that was developed?
Yes, Your Honor. There are nearby properties.
Was there any indication why they bought the property or how long they bought the property? Did they buy it as an investment property? Was it farm they inherited? What was the evidence about the purpose for buying it, or how long they held it?
I apologize, Your Honor. I do not believe that the answer to that was in the record in this case.
Thanks for not doing that.
Of course. But what is clear is that there were no current or pending plans for the project other than its current use, which was vacant. There is a long-term planning map by the city, and that did indicate that some parts of it in the long-term map could be rezoned. Not all of it. Not all of the rezoning that the Buttons experts showed. There were actually dozens of acres, an unspecified number because she didn't get into details, that were not even covered in the long-range planning map. However, the Texas Supreme Court case of Exxon v. Zwar says that it has to be a near-term development, that you look to what's happening, what is happening or is likely to occur in the near term, in the near future. So even that long-term map wouldn't provide any evidence to meet Exxon Vizoir's test for changing the use of the property.
They say that the applicable time consideration is reasonable.
Mm-hmm. They do, Your Honor. That just happens to not be what Exxon Vizoir says, which is that it is needed or likely to be needed in the near future. But backing up a step, you don't even really get to that question if all of the evidence with regard to the damages are speculative. It's completely based on a hypothetical development. Now, if you had a development on the table and people were discussing it, then we would have a different discussion. But here, it is not disputed that all of the development talk is hypothetical. It was a purely hypothetical discussion with regard to the development of this specific property. And in the Texas Supreme Court case, in case after case, the court has said that experts cannot testify to hypothetical and speculative uses of property. In City of Harlingen versus Estate of Charbonneau, the Texas Supreme Court said so in rejecting evidence based on a hypothetical neighborhood plan. A subdivision development. In Kermagee versus Helton, the court said that you couldn't testify, the experts can't testify to hypothetical speculation or surmise. In State v. Carpenter, the court said the evidence should be excluded when it relates to remote, speculative, or conjectural uses. In State v. Darmar, the court said that the courts must reject property valuation testimony based on speculative and hypothetical uses. In State versus Delaney, the Texas Supreme Court said that it barred recovery based on, quote, hypothetical development plans. But it's not just that it is hypothetical, and that too would exclude the evidence on its very nature. It's also that the Texas Supreme Court has said that there is a category of arguable injuries to remainder damages or to remainder properties that are by their very nature not compensable. And that category is when there is when part of the property is burdened and you want to get to the rest of the property. You cannot get damages for trying to access the rest of the property. And I actually, pointing back to the briefs again, if we could go to page 12 of the reply brief, if the court has that in front of it, I've actually never had a sentence in a case so precisely dispose of an issue. And I apologize that I didn't really realize it until I was preparing for oral argument. And that's on page 12 of our reply brief. And this is straight from State v. Delaney. The court says, quote, remaining property on which there are no improvements, as in this case, and to which reasonable access remains, as in this case, is not damaged simply because hypothetical development plans may have to be modified. Those are the precise situation in this case. The development plan is hypothetical. There is access from another highway. And the entirety of the testimony with regard to the claim, the nature of the claim, is that there were hypothetical development plans that would have to be modified. There would be complications if we develop the plan, the land a certain way. So under State v. Delaney, the damages cannot be sustained as a matter of law. In addition to Mr. Cross's testimony, the Buttons also offered the testimony of Ms. Jamie Wickliffe. Now, those two experts really come together to bring their claim, because Mr. Cross's claim was as to why or how the property was damaged, and that was it would be very difficult to develop the property in these certain spots, in these certain areas, because we might have to spend more money to move things around, to bridge something here or there. It would be more expensive to develop the property in certain spots. That's the nature of their claim. Now, upon that nature of the claim, Ms. Wickliffe then went to testified as to the quantification of those damages. Her testimony was all about the quantification of the damages that Mr. Cross offered for the reason for the claim. But Ms. Wickliffe's testimony really is no evidence in and of itself, because it only went to the quantification. And the type of damages that we're talking about, the very identity of the claim is one for which the Texas Supreme Court has said you can't, they are simply not compensable as a matter of law.
So you're saying your entire remainder of damages are based upon this burden of ingress, egress, and nothing else?
That's the only test, that is the nature of their claim that that Mr. Cross spoke about. He was saying that, and he didn't call it ingress and egress, and that part is true. He may have mentioned it here or there, but what he was talking about is it was going to cost more to develop this one side of the property if we did so, hypothetically, because of the burden of the easement.
But when she did her quantification, she did it based on so much per acre for commercial property and so much per acre for residential property, so it wouldn't be limited to just that part of damage, would it?
Well, what she did was she blended all together. Some kind of blender theory, which, to be honest, never really made sense to me. But it was, I'm going to look at all the factors in my head, everything that I've read, everything that I've looked at, all of the things that I've looked at. I'm going to kind of put them into a blender, and it's going to spit out an answer. And the answer she spit out was, it was $2.50 per square foot before and $2.25 per square foot afterwards. The difference over 144 acres was $1.5 million. Now, she didn't take, though, that, she never explained how she got to that. She never explained how she reached those conclusions, which is straight Kerr versus McGee. Kerr-McGee Corporation in the Texas Supreme Court. In that case, it was a damages in an oil well case, and the damages expert said that, look, I looked at all of these factors. I looked at the type of rock. I looked at other oil wells. I looked at everything in the area, and I determined that these are the amount of damages that should be awarded for failing to drill an oil well here. And the court said it doesn't even matter if all of those things they looked at are legitimate or were accurate. You can't just simply spit out an answer for what the damages are. You actually have to tie objectively and based on actual facts the things that you looked at to the conclusion that you drew. And all she does is spit out an answer, which we're not able to tie to anything. But remember, Your Honor, it's not just, what she's doing is quantifying damages. You can't just quantify damages in a condemnation case. It has to be an injury that is compensable. Because if all you did was give her testimony, then you would never know whether you had a compensable injury. You would just know that there is an alleged injury. You actually have to have an injury that is also compensable. And the issue is it a compensable injury? So if all she did was show damages, that would not be enough, because it has to be damages that are compensable under Texas law. And under Texas law, there can be no damages for what the court talked about in State v. Delaney. Accessing in a vacant property to which access remains, you can't get you can't get damages for the hypothetical development costs, the difficulties in developing in a hypothetical development. But in addition to the fact that she relies on Wickliffe's damages theory, and in fact tells us in her testimony that she relies on his testimony, on his analysis. But she also says, but I'm not going to put a dollar figure to it, so we can't back it out in any way. And because she kind of spits out this $2.25 and $2.50 thing, we can't back out all of the errors she made. They are what they are. And they're completely they're completely conclusory, which again, the Texas Supreme Court says, we're not going to allow that. We don't allow experts to just give their conclusion. They have to tie their conclusions to the factors that they have analyzed. But in addition to that, she also clearly erred by including comparables, in her comparable sales analysis, including comparables sales that were in fact not comparable, like sales that had high voltage electricity lines over there. She admitted that could have been the reason that those properties were damaged. But she said, I'm just going to throw them in there anyway. Now that might be okay under Exxon v. Middleton. The Texas Supreme Court says they don't have to be perfectly comparable, but if they aren't, you have to make adjustments for the things that aren't comparable. Again, she doesn't do that. She doesn't, in her analysis, explain how she reduced incomparable sales to make them more comparable. You have to do that to have a legitimate comparable sales analysis. She also included or excluded a known comparable. If you go to Exhibit E, I believe it is, to our opening brief, She includes the sales 4, 5, and 6 at the top of this map because they were burdened by a pipeline or a gathering line, a 10-inch gathering line in that case. But she excludes the sale at the bottom, which was not burdened. Now, if she had included that sale in her analysis, she would have learned that tract sold for approximately the same amount as the other tract, meaning that the tract that was not burdened by the pipeline sold for the same amount as the tracts burdened by the gathering lines. Now, the red light didn't go off, but I assume that means my time has expired. And if the court doesn't have any further questions, then I thank you.
Honorable Justices, the Barnett Shale has been an incredible boon to this area, but those benefits also come with burdens to landowners, and the Texas Constitution mandates that those burdens bring adequate compensation to those landowners.
Do you agree that they properly preserved their complaint?
I do not, because many of their complaints were not specifically set forth in the motion to exclude. In fact, none of them were, albeit the highest and best use and future zoning probability complaint. I agree they preserved that. The rest, no, because they never afforded the trial court the opportunity to rule on issues regarding accessibility, issues regarding so-called hypothetical development speculation. In any event, as the brief shows and as the evidence in this case shows, which is appellee's best brief, the record in this case, these access arguments were not made. These hypothetical subdivision prohibitions of Charbonneau used in valuing the case and based upon speculation and speculation and speculation are not applicable to this case. Both. I understand, and that. I understand, but I would say that with regard to these specific complaints, and the cases are cited in our brief, that you can't substitute a Daubert standard by failing to raise it, and that constitutes trial by ambush. I agree, and I'm no legal scholar, that the law has expanded and is liberal with regard to no evidence challenges, not requiring objections in many cases. But the cases also say that the trial court cannot correct error it is unaware of or unapprised of at trial. In any event, the objections were not made because the evidence complained of, the issues complained of, hypothetical subdivision, improper access cases, were not raised at trial. That's why there was no objection, because they were not brought forth in the evidence and they are nowhere in the record in this case. So you can't bootstrap yourself by lack of objection simply because the evidence wasn't proffered or wasn't presented, and that's what we have here. There are no unique or novel issues in this case. This case is not a proper candidate for appeal. The same type of evidence, if you'll look at the record, and I know the justices have, was proffered by both sides using the same methodology. Engineering testimony, straightforward engineering testimony, straightforward appraisal testimony. Engineers for both sides looking at crossing requirements, the easement itself, the burdens. The appellant wants to call this a hypothetical development or subdivision development case, but what this is a very straightforward damage case based on the fact that the highest and best of use of this property, as admitted by both sides, was for residential and commercial development. It does, and that was our burden to show that the current use, the use that it's being put to, is not its highest and best use, a burden that Ms. Wickliffe met over and over and over again in the record in this case by showing the development in the area, the sales in the area, the high prices paid for those sales, the market trends, interviews with market participants. Our burden, we met it clearly. Highest and best use was not even disputed. Mr. Piles conceded that this property is development property, commercial and residential. They had slight differences over the amount of commercial versus the amount of residential, but there was no dispute in this case by anyone that this was development property. Under appellant's theory, if you accept what they are arguing in their brief, there could mean no damages to a property that is not yet developed, and this court must ignore the highest and best use in assessing those damages because there's not an existing subdivision on the tract. That would be improper and contrary to case law from Carpenter forward. Property is valued based on its highest and best use. Damages to property are considered based on its highest and best use. Anything argument to the contrary would be wrong and contrary to Texas law, and that's what we have in this case. Yes, Justice Meyer.
What was the, was there a dispute as to the date of taking?
There was not.
And what date was that?
I believe it was July 7th, 2007. But I can't say exactly.
Are you talking about the date of the announcement of the award by the commissioners?
It would be when the
17th, 2007.
I'm sorry. It would be when the award is deposited, which I believe was in July, if I'm not mistaken.
I didn't see that in the briefs. It just said that the special commissioners determined on June 17th. I hadn't looked at that.
Well, the date of take is when the award is actually filed, so that would be the date of the hearing. But the date of take, according to both appraisers and undisputed by both sides, was, I believe, in July of 2007, shortly thereafter. Yes, sir. And the date is specifically in the evidence because both appraisers. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Well, Justice Gabriel, I'm glad you know that.
And in terms of the property's status at that time, it was 144-acre undeveloped tract.
It was. Being held for development, just as many tracts are.
What was the evidence as to the length of time that that 144-acre tract had been a single contiguous tract?
It had been, as far as I know, the ownership in this family is as far back as I go, but it had been a single fact since the Buttons acquired it back in 2003, and I'm sure before that, but I think that would be outside the record, actually.
Well, I'm just asking.
I believe forever. As far as I know, the evidence showed that it had been during the relevant time frame in this case. 144 acres contiguous with separate economic units as testified to by both sides, but contiguous property. And much akin to the Carruth property across from North Park Mall. It was undeveloped for many years, but everyone in the real estate business and real estate market knew that was prime development property. If you place a pipeline through the middle of it, the impact is going to be on that property. And I want to point out to the court that this is not a cost case. If this had been developed by some developer already, perhaps this would have been a cost case. But contrary to what the appellant argues, it's not a cost case. This is a diminution in value case based on what market participants, that is buyers who want to develop the property potentially, would discount their price because of the presence and constraints posed by the pipeline. A pipeline which is not an access issue, because access to the public road, which all of the cases, Dalmar, Delaney, any of them you look at are talking about, was not an issue. It's once you access the property from the public road, the interior problems caused by the pipeline and the crossing requirements are what caused the diminution in value and damages in this tract. Reams of evidence testified to by Mr. Cross about his extensive experience in that and why the market would react to that, and Ms. Wickliffe explained how the market reacted to it. Interestingly, appellant talks about and seems to have a problem with opinion evidence in this case and confuse opinion evidence with speculative conclusory evidence. The reason we must have opinions in a condemnation case is because the property was taken by the appellant, precluding a sale, precluding knowing what the market would do in absence of the pipeline. Necessarily by both sides, we must have appraisers who give opinions of what that effect would be, albeit supported by evidence, comparable sales. The record is clear that she did show her adjustments. She brought her sales, compared them to the subject property, and used the classic direct sales comparison approach. No problem there, no issue. I dispute the testimony or characterization of Ms. Wickliffe's analysis as conclusory. The record will show she did not solely rely on Mr. Cross for her conclusion of damages and how the market would react to the presence of this pipeline, the crossing requirements, the easements, the constraints, the complications. She had vast experience herself. She brought forth to the jury paired sales analysis. She interviewed market participants. All of this was testified to separate and independent of Mr. Cross. Her evidence, her testimony standing alone, would have provided much more than a scintilla of evidence under the no evidence standard. This is simply not a no evidence case. These witnesses did not testify in any speculative or conclusory manner. The zoning issue...
You said that in brief.
Yes.
You cited in his brief and in fact read just a little while ago a portion of the testimony where your expert was giving hypotheticals and saying, if this, then that. If
that was...
then why?
I understand.
How can you say that there was nothing hypothetical in his testimony when you see it there?
Perhaps I should be more clear. There's nothing conclusory in the testimony. It was based on evidence. The hypothetical issue is one we must be careful about and read the cases carefully, because hypothetical subdivision and valuation of property based on hypothetical speculative subdivisions is prohibited by Charbonneau. We're not talking about that in any way, shape, or form. How a property might hypothetically develop and potential constraints, complications to that development that's admitted to be the best use of this property by both sides are completely admissible. And cases like Ammerman, Hunt, LaSalle Pipeline show that you can have vacant tracts of land, and if their highest and best use is impacted, the jury is entitled to know how those impacts could occur and what a buyer who's thinking about buying this property and to develop it would be thinking about, what he would be concerned about as it relates to how, whether he would buy the property or she, or whether he or she would pay a price that they would pay before the pipeline. There are some hypotheticals that have to be engaged in with regard to damages because the property might not develop, but those were not assigned particular costs because they couldn't be. And that evidence was not the type that was prohibited by the case law. That was merely evidence of why the market value of this tract is diminished due to the complications of the pipeline. Two entirely separate considerations, although the word hypothetical, as used by appellate, is an attempt to trip the court up or confuse two concepts that are entirely different. Charbonneau doesn't apply. That's set forth in our brief. I hope that answers your question. The appellant, two facts clearly show that...
I'm going to ask you one more question.
Yes, sir, Justice Meyer.
Have you looked at the, I'm sure you know this, map that is attached as Exhibit D to the appellant's brief?
I'm sure I have, Your Honor.
Well, it's a map that's purporting to show the location of the pipeline.
Yes, sir.
And it looks to me like it is right on the very... western edge of the property, and it's defined in length and what is involved with the property is on the map itself. And I just want to know if at the time that you all tried this, what had happened in terms of the actual development of the pipeline? Had it been put in place?
Yes, it was there.
It was already there.
Yes,
sir. Wasn't any question, that's just where it is.
This is where it is, and it was not adjacent to the road. There was some room, although not a lot of room in much of the area, more room as you move to the northern portion. But there was room to access. The property was accessible from the public road. There was no dispute about that, but the pipeline certainly lie close to the frontage on the public road, which incidentally caused the damages in this case because that road frontage property was some of the most valuable property, part of it commercial, part of it residential, and assigned those values. Appellant is simply attempting to misdirect words that sound the same in case law, but concepts that are completely different. And I'm confident if you read our brief and read the cases carefully, that will become clear. Both sides testified with the facts regarding this pipeline and its impacts. Mr. Cross, Ms. Wickliffe. Ms. Wickliffe more than met the evidence standard for her highest and best use. Reed Carlisle Grace, She testified that this property was available and the zoning would be anticipated in the very near future. In fact, probably upon request. Mr. Piles, the appraisal expert for the appellant, did not dispute that using residential and agricultural sales to reach commercial prices in this market, testifying that he anticipated a zoning change would be no issue either. It was agreed to by both sides, more than met the standard of Rankin and others in this instance. Not a hypothetical subdivision valuation case. Read Charbonneau. Don't just look at the quotes ellipsed, but look at the full testimony about the problems in valuation, which were not at issue here. Our best brief, I state again, is the record at trial. A reversal of this verdict would turn over 80 years of well-settled condemnation law, starting with Carpenter, and it would just turn it on its ear. And that is appellate's hope in this case, and though it may be appellate's hope, it is a hope contrary to Texas law and the evidence presented in this case. I ask you to simply read the record. The bullet points they complain about are not bullet points. They are recitation of reams of evidence by both sides agreeing to many of the issues that are now disputed in this case. To call this a no evidence case would be highly improper. Thank you, Justices. My light is on.
I have four quick points I think I can get in 5 minutes. The first is with respect to Judge Dolfino's question regarding preservation of error. And it is clear in this case that error was preserved in at least three ways. One, under the Texas Supreme Court's case of Harris County Bail Bond Board versus Blackwood, there need not be an objection. A post-judgment motion is enough to preserve error in a no-evidence case. And we did exactly that. We had a post-judgment motion that raised every single argument that is in our brief, and therefore there is no waiver. Second, preservation by pre-testimony objection. In Guadalupe Blanco River Authority versus Kraft, the Texas Supreme Court said that all someone had to do to preserve error in a case involving exactly the issues here, appraisal in a condemnation case, you just had to simply rise before the testimony and say that you objected to, this is the objection in that case. I'm going to make an objection based upon the failure of this witness's methodology to meet the reliability standards as articulated by the Texas Supreme Court. That's it. We did far more than that in two pre-trial motions objecting to the testimony. And third, there need not be an objection to conclusory or speculative testimony, expert testimony, and that's under two recent Texas Supreme Court cases, General Motors Corporation versus Arachetta and Coastal Transport Corp versus Crown Central. For many reasons, all of the objections that we have made are properly before the court. Second, now, one of the, I think, the more interesting things that we heard in the Appellee's argument was that this isn't really, even though our guy testified to all these hypothetical costs, it's really not a hypothetical cost case because we didn't, we say it's not. And the Texas Supreme Court in State v. Bristol had exactly that before the court, where someone said, well, we realize that we can't get away with that stuff, but we say that this is a market perception case, which is exactly the words that the Appellee's used in this case, that they want to convert hypothetical costs into a market perception case. And the Texas Supreme Court said you can't do that. You can't call it something other. You can't say that it's market perception when the numbers that you get from market perception are based on the so-called injury of increased costs to hypothetically develop a property. So even if it's true, even if you grant them everything they said, which is that someone might not buy this property for as much because they believe there are hypothetical development costs, Texas Supreme Court says that's not enough. You can't do that. So even if there is an injury, even if they proved it, it's not one that's compensable, and that goes back to State v. Delaney, which is really the heart and soul of this appeal. The court could not have been more clear. There's no wiggle room here. Remaining property on which there are no improvements and to which reasonable access remains is not damaged simply because hypothetical development plans may have to be modified. Doesn't matter whether you call that market perception, doesn't matter whether you call that hypothetical developments, doesn't matter what you call it. If those things are the facts before the court, which they are in this case, then there is no compensable injury as a matter of Texas law.
I speculated his reasoning would have changed. How speculative is losing road frontage?
I don't think that has, it's not speculative, I guess, would answer your question, but that has been compensated for. Let's not forget that the Buttons were compensated $125,000 for the burden on their property, for the property that was directly burdened by, we did not appeal that. We have not appealed the $125,000 judgment that they got for the direct burden of the property, of the easement on that property. What they're claiming is that they also get another $700,000 for the rest of their property being burdened, being indirectly burdened. And that is what we're appealing, Your Honor. That is what they don't get based on clear, settled Texas Supreme Court authority. And I think that actually, I think you led me to my fourth point, which was that they've already been compensated for the, this is not a case in which they haven't been compensated. They were directly compensated for the burden on their property. This is a question of, do they get to also say that the rest of their property was damaged based on the easement that we did already pay for, that we have not appealed? And based on State v. Delaney, that quote is the beginning and end of this case. And if the court has no further questions, I would yield the remainder of it. Yes, sir.
There's a reference in the brief to a portion of what was agreed on that there could be crossings on the easement, but that the crossings had to be at a particular angle, and that was the limitation on the crossings. If the easement is where it's shown in your exhibit that I was talking about a minute ago, right along the western edge of the property, and then if it is accessible across that easement, just you can't come at it directly perpendicular, you have to cross it at an angle. Then where's the argument about there being a limitation by the location?
We would agree that, Your Honor, that there isn't a huge burden on even the property underneath the easement, because they can, as you said, that's in the petition. The petition and condemnation is the language that you're reading from.
What evidence was there, if there was any, about what would be the likelihood of damage to the pipeline in the easement by having construction over the top of it? What is the likelihood that if you ran concrete across the top of it, that you might have some problem with damaging the pipeline because of that weight of the concrete over the top of the easement?
The easement under, if it's in the clerk's record at page 8, which is that had to be buried 48 inches at least. It's a 20-foot wide easement. It's a 6-inch gathering line. This is not a full pipeline. This is just a gathering line to gather the gas. The testimony was, I'm not sure if the testimony was quite specific as to, you know, how much weight they could put on it, but the testimony was that you could, in fact, drive over it. The testimony was that there would be no buildings built on top of it, but that you could drive over it, you could put a driveway over it, as long as you did so at a 45-degree angle. But as we discussed earlier, Your Honor, that has been compensated for. To the extent the property is burdened by directly burdened by the easement, the Buttons got $125,000, and we did not appeal. Maybe we should have. but we did not appeal. Right. We have. We did not appeal that part of the judgment. That's correct, Your Honor.